Killer Innovations Podcast for Saturday, May 21st, 2005, coming to you from rainy Bangkok, Thailand. Welcome to the Killer Innovations Podcast. I'm your host, Phil McKinney. Please keep in mind that the opinions expressed in this podcast are mine alone, and do not reflect those of my past, current, or future employers. Thanks for all the feedback. I've been getting a number of emails from you, the listeners, and they've been very encouraging and a lot of great input. One email that I got this last week, and actually it just echoes a number of the ones I've had over the last couple of weeks, is some feedback on the format change that we've made based on wanting to get immediately into the content and to kind of shorten the personal upfront chit-chat. A number of you have commented that you actually miss that. I guess there's a little bit of voyeurism in all of us and wanting to hear about what I'm seeing on my travels as I go around the world. So we're going to change a little bit. I'm going to maybe expand here at the end of this show and give you some insights into what I'm working on and what I'm doing personally. Also, we have gotten some questions in, a number of them by email, so at the end I will also be answering the listener questions. And then also there's been some questions about what configuration I'm using when I'm on the road, and how do I record the podcast and get it up there, given that I'm doing these things from, you know, this. Today I'm here in Bangkok, Thailand. Last week's show came to you from Bali, Indonesia. I've done them from Europe, from the States, and literally 100% of the podcasts that I've done so far have been on a mobile platform, from hotel rooms, etc. So I'll give you a little bit more insight into how I actually go about creating the podcasts while I'm on the road, given the uncertainty of broadband and all the other challenges when traveling into some of these more exotic locations. So again, I'm going to put those at the end of the podcast, so those of you who want to hang on to past the normal segment can spend a little bit more time with me. Then I'll share with you, again, what I'm seeing, some of the interesting things I've come across on the road, particularly this trip here in Southeast Asia. Again, listener questions, and then share with you the configuration that I'm using to create this podcast. In today's segment, we're going to have the normal three segments that we have in the previous podcast. Segment one today, we're going to talk about breakthrough versus incremental innovation. Segment two, we're going to talk about science fiction writing, and the role it could play in helping you identify weak signals or early trends before they get widely adopted. And then, as we normally do, segment three, we will have the killer question of the week. So let's go ahead and jump right in. In segment one, we're going to talk about breakthrough versus incremental innovation. All of us would love to be the one inventor of the absolute killer breakthrough innovation that fundamentally changes society and has a huge impact on people's lives. Reality is those are very far and few between. The real challenge that we have, though, is that human nature is not accepting of change or radical change. Keep in mind that really, when you think about the innovations that have been hugely successful in the marketplace, those that have really won wide market adoption and wide acceptance from customers are those that really just stay ahead of the competition. The key here, though, is to stay ahead of the competition and just far enough ahead of your customers so they can still understand what your product is and how to incorporate it into their lives and businesses. Every customer has a point of reference, point of reference being how they do their tasks and their jobs today, day to day. And again, human behavior is much slower to change than technology. I've been in this industry, or the computer industry, since the late 70s, early 80s, and the early launch of the Apple and IBM PC, etc. And even in those early days, great technology, but the technology in many cases got ahead of the customers or the customer's ability to integrate it into their day-to-day business. And so when you look back at all the technologies and innovations that have been hugely successful, the ones that really got that traction were those that that really didn't demand really excessive change from the customer. The customer could figure out how to roll that into the existing or into their existing lifestyle. So, what I've identified really are eight characteristics to this role of incremental innovation. Now, incremental doesn't mean less valuable or it has less impact. It's simply recognizing that any innovation, you have to find the path to acceptance, find the path to the customers adopting this technology and ultimately buying it and generating the revenue for you, the generators of these ideas. So, let's walk through again these eight characteristics that I've identified that are really ways for you to find a path to getting acceptance of the ideas and innovations that you're developing. Number one, provable. Can the product be demonstrated on a pilot basis or a trial basis? Is it something that's easily demonstrable? Can they try it out in a smaller scale before they commit to replacing everything that they currently have? Second one is divisible. Can it be adopted in segments or in phases? Can they ease into it rather than having to take the big leap off the cliff to take on and do or utilize whatever your product or service is? Next, is it reversible? If it doesn't work, can the customer return it? Can they back it out? Can they stop using it and return back to their old method? Next is tangible. And this is critically important. Are the results or the benefits easily recognizable by the customer? Are they tangible? Are they going to make a difference in something that the customer needs or values? Next is, does it fit prior investments? Does it build upon the investments that the customers already have made? In this case, is it something that builds upon those investments, meaning does it allow them to get better leverage of something that they've already invested in? One possible example, for instance, is the innovation that's occurring today in what we call the digital home. So set-top boxes, personal video recorders, these build upon the investment that the customer already has made, whether it be satellite TV or broadband connections into the home to deliver IPTV. So it builds upon, allows them to leverage the customer's investment they've already made and to have a better experience into something they already have today. Next is it familiar? Does it feel like things the customer's already understands? Or is it so different that you literally have to go out and educate and train the customer? If you're in this latter case where you literally have to go out and educate and train the customer, you have a huge investment model that you have to commit to in order to get the customer comfortable in buying whatever that innovation is. Next is what you're bringing to market congruent with future directions? Are there natural trends that customers are moving down, such as IP telephony, broadband into the home, wireless broadband into the devices? Are there natural trends that are occurring, and is what you're doing part of that natural path? Or are you creating a completely different path that requires you again to get the customer to stop the path or stop the way that they're thinking now as far as what the next natural step would be and to move in a completely different direction? And last but not least is publicity value. Will it make the customer look better to itself, to others? Is there some cachet? Is it some breakthrough from the standpoint of not the technology, but in the way that it's positioned? The Apple iPod being a perfect example on that. There were many MP3 players that existed prior to the iPod coming out, but when you think about all of these things, it's provable. Yes, the iPod, clearly you could demonstrate it in the store. It was divisible. I could use it just for music and then adopt it for other things. Was it reversible? Yeah, I could stop using it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can run through the entire list, apply it to the iPod, and clearly see where the incremental innovation clearly came in on the iPod. But ultimately, it came down to publicity value, the cachet of being one of the early users, or even now today, even still the popularity of the device, the ability to use that device from the standpoint of the benefit, but also the ability of kind of the cool or hipness that comes from that. So again, the eight characteristics that are key to success in delivering your innovation to the marketplace and getting adoption. And I'm calling it incremental, but again, don't take incremental as being negative. But again, the eight characteristics are provable, divisible, reversible, tangible, fits prior investments, it's familiar, it's congruent with future directions or trends, and it has publicity value. So go back, look at the ideas and innovations that you're working on, map them against these, identify how you can leverage these in delivering your innovation to the marketplace, and you'll have success. Now, moving on to segment two. Segment two, talking about weak signals. One of the questions I do get quite often is, how do I go off and identify the weak signals that are part of the day-to-day job that I'm responsible for? In my current role, I have responsibility to develop and maintain what we call a 5 to 8 year roadmap in the industries and markets that I'm responsible for the company that I work for. I'm a senior technology executive at a Fortune 500 high-tech firm. And again, my role is to look out towards the future and plan and develop these roadmap strategies. One of the questions I got from one of the readers was, so how do you go out? What is the process that you go through to try to find or identify emerging trends early and then map those futures out? Well, in my role, part of the challenge that I have is how do you really take a view of that longer range? I mean, we all tend to focus on the next year, 18 months kind of planning cycles. How do you really get your head around thinking 5, 8, 10 years out? And how do you build that up in a sense of confidence? One way for me is to generate or to capture lots of ideas and then filter those through to create these long-range plans. One of the sources for ideas for me is reading science fiction. Now, I'm not a science fiction nut, albeit I like Star Trek, but I would not classify myself as a Trekkie. I like the Star Wars movies, but I'm not a fanatic. My interest in these sources of future views is simply as a source of ideas. And one of the interesting writers in science fiction who I have found to be extremely, extremely insightful is an author by the name of Philip K. Dick. Now, many of you know Phil's work, but you may not recognize it or know that it was Philip Dick who actually created this material. In this case, or what they some of his fans will call him is PKD, but Phil's work has led to six blockbuster movies that have been out in the marketplace. And so I'm going to give you 2 seconds here to see if you can name all six blockbuster science fiction movies that are based on Phil Dick's short stories. Well, if you were lucky, you could probably name one or two. But let me run through the list. First up was Blade Runner. Came out in 1982. It's based on a Phil Dick short story called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? He wrote the story in 1968. The movie came out in 1982, starring Harrison Ford. It was a huge blockbuster. Other stories of Phil Dick that came out include Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was based on a Phil Dick short story called We Can Remember It for You Wholesale, which he wrote in 1966. Other ones include Screamers, It was based on a short story called Second Variety that Phil wrote in 1953. The Imposter, based on a short story called Imposter that Phil wrote in 1953. Minority Report, starring Tom Cruise, was based on a short story called Minority Report that Phil Dick wrote in 1956. The Minority Report movie came out in 2002. And not too long ago, and actually one of my favorite ones of the Phil Dick movies, was Paycheck, starring Ben Affleck. Again, it came off of a short story named Paycheck that Phil Dick wrote in 1953. So when you think about, in this case, Phil Dick's writing, and by the way, he's no longer alive. His daughters now manage his stories from the standpoint of movie rights, etc. But he was probably one of the most prolific science fiction writers. And I find going back and reading his material and his ability to think about, movies that you've seen, whether it be Minority Report, Paycheck, Blade Runner, these were all written in the late 50s and early 60s. And here they are, you make them into modern movies and you think of them as being really a perspective of technology. Think about it. 1956, the Minority Report short story was written, and it was before PCs, before cellular phones, before any of the modern technologies, retinal scans, hand scans. But all of those technologies are in that short story. So when you think about the ability of science fiction writers, just the way they're wired, and their ability to identify and create these kind of imaginary futures, they become just absolutely phenomenal sources of ideas that you can use from the standpoint of just identifying what some of the possible trends and what are some of the early weak signals. Now, in my case, I do go to the bookstore and I buy the science fiction mini paperback magazines that are published on a monthly basis, such as Analog. Now, at the same time, I do spend a lot of time on airplanes, and I also, however, am self-conscious of sitting in business class reading what many would refer to as kind of lower class writing. So I do actually obscure the cover. I am a little sensitive to not wanting to be viewed as a kook, but I find the writing and the imagination that science fiction writers bring to the market to be just a great source of ideas and allows me to kind of step out of kind of the day-to-day challenges and pressures of today's world, think about what the future may look like, and apply that to my own creative thinking and the innovations that I'm trying to build in my day-to-day job. So again, don't look down upon, looking at these kinds of third-party sources of information, science fiction, whether that's books, magazines, short novels, movies, are phenomenal sources of ways for you to think differently about what the future may hold and how does that roll into your innovation source. And next time you're at the bookstore, walk over to the rack that has the science fiction magazines. Look for some of the ones such as Analog. They're the mini paperback novels. Pick up the most recent edition and take it home for a read. I think you'll be amazed at some of the ideas that will come out. In segment three, this week's killer question is one that I pulled out of the card deck that I think is one that I've been thinking about here lately, given some of the adoption and some of the wild successes that some of the new technologies have been having, such as the iPod, or the interest in some of the new gaming machines, such as the new Microsoft Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, etc. So this week's killer question is, what emotional, psychological, or status benefit do people derive from using my product or service? So again, what emotional, psychological, or status benefit do people derive from using my product? Now, there are some obvious examples in this case, such as clothes and the designer clothes and, the big names, whether it be Calvin Klein or, any of the new modern brands. I'm not into the whole clothes thing, so I'm not up to speed on all the new hot areas in that space. But one area in technology that I have been kind of a keen observer on, for instance, is the area around the BlackBerry. Now, the BlackBerry being the device that allows you to get your email pushed to that device as the email comes in to your mailbox. Now, I actually ended up being one of the early implementers of BlackBerry. In a previous role, in a previous life, I was the chief information officer for a publicly traded company, and the senior executives were quick to adopt BlackBerry as really the means of communications. This was back in the mid-90s, so this tells you how long ago. I mean, I was literally one of the early implementers of BlackBerry in a corporate environment. And it quickly became evident that it was a huge status symbol within the organization. I mean, all the senior vice presidents had it. Then all the vice presidents were jockeying for it. And if one vice president got it and another vice president didn't get it, then there was this status perception that you were not at the same level. Title didn't matter anymore. It mattered whether or not you had that device. In fact, it got so crazy at one point in time that HR had to step in and we had to define who got it based on role and definition by title in order not to cause any kind of division within the organization. I mean, it was just one of those phenomena. I mean, today, we're talking, 10 years later, after the BlackBerry has emerged. And even today, you'll find that the BlackBerry is clearly very much of a status symbol. Executives are very quick to pull it off their hip and be typing frantically away with their thumbs. And basically, the status symbol now has shifted to the I am so important that I cannot be disconnected from my office, and that the business would not survive if I wasn't connected kind of mindset. I mean, it's gotten so severe that orthopedic surgeons now are doing surgeries on thumbs of executives who've done so much thumb typing that they've caused degenerative cartilage disease in the thumbs. Other kinds of products, innovations, technologies that benefit, I guess, from answering this killer question are things like cars. Do I drive the Lexus? Or do I drive some other kind of a car? It was interesting. A couple of days ago, I was in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and having lunch with some executives there. And the one executive that I was having lunch with had explained that the night before, his car was stolen. Actually, it was carjacked. It's quite common in Malaysia for executives to have private drivers. So his car was parked in front of the restaurant. His driver was sitting in the car. He and his family were in the restaurant eating, and the carjackers came up and basically put a gun to the head of the driver, kidnapped the car and the driver, took the car, and released the driver a couple of hours later. And the car had a GPS tracking mechanism in it, but the car has never been recovered. They showed it being driven around. They showed it being driven to a port location along the North China Sea, and the car was lost. It never was recovered. So in some cases, the status symbol of products also encourages other unpredicted second order effects, such as copies, illegal copying, such as movies, clothing, pictures, those types of things, or increase in crime rate for people who want to have that status symbol but who don't want to pay the full price, will create kind of the mother of invention of opening up a crime where people will steal your status symbol and give it to somebody else at a lower price. So again, going back to the killer question, what emotional, psychological, or status benefit do people derive from using my product? And a twist to that question is, could you build in to your product or strategy an emotional, psychological, or status benefit? And use that as the hook for your customers to see the benefits and to have that emotional attachment to the ideas and innovation that you're creating. And with that, we're going to wrap up this week's show. I want to leave a little bit of extra time here at the end to respond to some of the feedback that I've gotten via email. So first up, we're going to address some listener questions that have come in by email. So this week's listener question comes from Jay. He's actually just a recently graduated student in Germany. His major is in multimedia design. And actually, his email address came back with a domain of ideatemple.de. Now, I went out to the site. My German's not all that great, but it looks like it's a kind of a creativity idea site to encourage people to come together for ideas. So, for those of you who know German, take and enjoy the site. There's not an English option. I wish there was, but there's not an English option on this site. And also, I'll probably contact Jay and in the future and have him kind of maybe share a paragraph or two more about the Idea Temple. So it's ideatemple.de. So the questions that Jay had asked was, one, what's the best way to protect intellectual property? So if you're an inventor or you're creating ideas, what's the best way to protect it? Now, I'm not a lawyer, so this is not legal advice, and it varies pretty widely from country to country, albeit I do have responsibility as the intellectual property coordinator for ideas and patents and such that are created for the company that I work for. So I do have to deal with this on a worldwide basis, but if it's a copyrighted area, whether that be text that you write, music you create, or things such as even things like this podcast, you can leverage the equivalent of copyright protection for that material. If it's a business process, tangible product, engineering manufacturing process, or what we call kind of utility invention, then I would encourage you to look at going through the patenting process. Now, the patenting process varies from country to country. If you've already disclosed your patent, meaning that you've written about it, you've talked about it, you've shared it with others, you may have already forfeited the right to the patent because of what's called disclosures. So you need to be very careful about if you've come up with an idea and you've put it down into your notebooks, then you want to protect that and not share it with others unless they're under some kind of a non-disclosure or they have some kind of you have some kind of an agreement that they recognize that you own it and that what you've shared with them is not for public discussion. Minimally, you should maintain an idea or innovation notebook. I actually carry two notebooks with me at all times. They are Moleskine notebooks. I get them from the Design Museum in London. The manufacturer is Moleskine, Moleskine. You can get them pretty much anywhere in the world. I use the graph paper version. And I literally never go anywhere without my notebooks. And as I come up with ideas and inventions and innovations, I document them, I sketch them out. The important thing here is not that you date them, but that you need to have it witnessed. So, from a standpoint of idea ownership, one of the key criteria is being able to prove who came up with the idea first. So if you maintain your idea notebook and you're sketching and you're defining ideas, the critical next step is make sure that you get your pages signed off by somebody who is a witness, who can understand the invention, meaning that you've explained it to them, they understand it, and then they need to sign off, literally put signature to those same pages in your notebook such that you have an audit trail to go back. Again, I'm not providing legal advice. I would encourage you to retain an attorney appropriate to the geography you live in, but there's just some critical ideas. Second question that Jay had was, is how do large companies evaluate ideas? Meaning if you're an inventor or somebody who's coming up with individual ideas, what's the process that you should interact with large companies who potentially would be interested to evaluate your ideas? Well, this is kind of one that hits close to home because this is part of my role for the company that I work for, where I literally travel around, meet with small companies, large companies, look at their intellectual properties to either acquire or invest in. And the key here is in the first meeting, large companies are not going to be interested in hearing about the nitty-gritty intellectual properties. The first meeting should only cover publicly available information about your company, in general terms about the area and space of your technology. This is basically for protection of the large companies. I can't recount how many times small companies come in and have a discussion. They think they're revealing something totally new, totally innovative, but it's actually right in a sweet spot in which we are doing deep research and development on. And so we already have parallel activities in the exact same space currently underway. And so therefore, later on, maybe a year or 2 years from now, we come out with a product, and this small company then is upset because they think we've stolen their ideas and have put them into some kind of a commercial offering. And I can tell you that large companies, I can't say there's universal, but from a general sense, large companies are not going to be interested in stealing the ideas because of the negative publicity should that comes with that. Plus, it's just much easier, much cheaper to go ahead and buy and acquire the technology, acquire the patents, than it is to go through all the legal issues of charges that are occurred later on. But you have to recognize that large companies, such as the company I work for, we spend billions of dollars a year in our research and development. Now that's not to say that small companies or small inventors aren't going to come up with ideas that we're not working on, but in many cases, there may be parallel areas or areas that we currently have R&D funding in, and so therefore that becomes a problem. Most large companies have some kind of a technology evaluation process. They have a formalized team that's kind of sheltered off from the rest of the internal organization, the research and development. So this is kind of a Chinese wall. In the case of the company I work for, we do have a formalized process. Small companies can come in, meet, demonstrate their technologies, demonstrate their ideas, and very quickly these organizations can identify level of interest, who should be the right contacts within the organization, and help you manage the process. The key here is that you want to make sure that you're talking to the right levels and the right people within any of these large organizations, and not just talking to random engineers. Or random people within the process. So most large corporations, whether they be the high-tech companies such as Microsoft, Intel, whoever, large manufacturing companies such as Procter and Gamble, etc., large auto manufacturers, they're all looking for ideas. You, if you're an individual inventor, someone generating individual ideas, large companies recognize that it's the smaller individual inventors who are the ones that are coming up with those next ideas. And they are anxious to find you, and they are anxious to uncover the ideas that you may bring that would have impact on their business. So don't be discouraged, but also be careful about how you go through the process of dealing with these large companies to make sure that your ideas are properly protected, and that you don't feel as though your ideas were stolen later on, should they also have similar R&Ds currently underway. So hopefully, again, these answered the two questions that Jay posed. Go out and see ideatemple.de. If you know German, you'll even enjoy it even more. Jay, again, thank you for your question. Second thing in the conclusion area that we're going to talk about is really is observations from the road. Number of listeners have sent me emails saying that they've kind of missed the segment that I used to do in the upfront portion, talking about what is it I'm doing on the road, what am I seeing, etc. So I'm just gonna take a few minutes here, kind of give you a quick update. I am currently on the road. I'm in Southeast Asia. Today I'm in Bangkok, Thailand, albeit it's raining like you would not believe outside. It is the rainy season here. I started off the trip about a week and a half ago in Bali, Indonesia. Went to Jakarta. I went to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. I'm now in Bangkok. I leave tomorrow for Sydney, Australia. And then Monday night, I am in Singapore. And then I'll be in Singapore through 2 or 3 days. And then I'm back on the airplane heading back to the US. Some quick observations from what I'm seeing in Southeast Asia here is one is I've kind of forgotten about the what customer service really means. If you really want to have an understanding of what true customer service is, come to Southeast Asia. I've stayed at many very nice hotels and very nice resorts. I stayed at the Intercontinental on the island of Bali, and I'm telling you, I've never had a customer service experience like that. It is absolutely unbelievable, the level of service, the level of the people being in tune with what your needs and wants are. Literally, they can predict what it is you need or want and have it right there for you before you even make the request. It's something that all of us can learn from the standpoint of really predicting the needs of our customers. Also, some of the other observations that I've seen is also the impact in the region from the terrorism in both Bali and in Jakarta. I actually stayed at the JW Marriott Hotel in Jakarta, which is the same Marriott hotel that was bombed. You would not believe the security measures. I mean, it's actually harder to get into the lobby of the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta than it is for you to get on an international airplane today. So, I mean, I felt extremely safe even with the unrest that's currently going on in Indonesia today. It is under travel restrictions for obvious reasons, but it's having a very disastrous impact on the economy in the region with high unemployment and stagnation of the economies for these countries. Bali is still recovering from the bombing there, and again, it's just up close and personal, actually seeing the impact and the results from these from the terrorisms and the impact that it has on the economies and the people there who depend on whether that be tourism or external investors, whatever the case might be. I'm now in Bangkok, Thailand, where I'm albeit not being able to directly see the impact, but having met with local press, etc. here in Thailand, to understand the impact of the tsunami here and the impact that's having on the economy. In fact, in yesterday's paper here in Bangkok, they talked about the fact that the there was immediate influx of support and that came in right after the tsunami, but that obviously has now left because it's not on the front page of the newspapers. So the economy kind of got a little bit of a boost coming out of the tsunami, but now the real economic impact of the tsunami is being felt here within the region. It's putting a lot of downward pressure on the economy and therefore on the local people living here. So it's still having a long-term impact, but I'm amazed at how optimistic the people here in the region are, and how grateful they are for the support that they've gotten from other parts of the world and recognition for the challenges they're facing with the tsunami. People here are just truly appreciative, but I think now that it's out of the main light and people aren't seeing it and every day on the news, that we've kind of forgotten about it. So that's now starting to have the ripple effect as the region goes through the reconstruction. So those are just some of the observations that I'm seeing from the road here. The other piece that people were interested in is what is the configuration that I use for generating this podcast from the road. The only computer I carry with me is a tablet computer. It happens to be an HP T1100 tablet. It's about a year old. It has all the connectivity that I need, wireless Wi-Fi and my internet, NIC connection, etc. I use Sony SoundForge and Sony Acid Pro to process the audio files, to do the recording, and then process them. Because I'm on the road and I have a variety of background noises and different hotel rooms, etc., I do a lot of noise reduction and processing on the audio files to clean them up before I post them up. I do use a headset. However, this is not a headset you can buy as of yet. It's a proprietary, or I shouldn't say proprietary, it's a prototype headset that I actually got from the guys at Skype. I was in the Skype headquarters in London. Oh, I don't know, it's got to be 2 or 3 months ago. And they actually gave me a headset that one of the headset manufacturers has built. It's a little bit like an over-the-ear headset that you see with cellular phones, but it's designed specifically for use with Skype. And I found it just works very, very well directly into the sound card on my tablet to do the recording. So thanks to the guys at Skype. This has made it very, very easy for me to do very good clean recordings while I'm on the road. And then for those all you techie geek types, I use a software program called Feed4All to create the RSS feeds that I post up onto the site. So hopefully that addresses your curiosity into how I do the actual recording of the podcast while I'm on the road. Now the only thing I do need is broadband everywhere. And if I had broadband everywhere, then things would be much simpler for me. So again, we're gonna wrap this up. I've probably gone over way over the time now, but I do appreciate you if you've listened this far into the podcast. Please send me feedback. Email us podcast@killerinnovations.com. Visit the website. I'll have the show notes posted, so killerinnovations.com. Please don't forget to vote. Please go to Podcast Alley, vote for the podcast, vote for all of the podcasts that you listen to. That's how all of us can measure kind of the acceptance and the listener base on whether or not you like the work that we're investing. I mean, for every 30-minute podcast, I'm probably spending 5 to 6, 7 hours preparing for it. So it's a huge amount of investment for all of the people creating these podcasts, and taking a little bit of time to voting at Podcast Alley for all of your podcasts is just one way of letting the people know that you appreciate the effort that they put into this. And also, don't forget to call the feedback line, which is +1. 703-636-4460. And if you phone into the feedback line, I'll play that back on a future podcast. Pose your questions there, and then that way you can become part of this podcast, and you can get the credit for asking some interesting questions that that we respond to. So, again, hope you're enjoying the podcast, and thank you for listening.